You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Good afternoon. We're going to go ahead and get started. It looks like we have a kind of critical mass for the people that want to attend this session. Doing okay on volume there? So we're here to talk about cybersecurity. It's become one of these issues that all of us who work on this, sometimes you spend half your time explaining what it is that we're talking about. And then when I was watching television the other day, I saw that DeVry University now actually has a degree you can study for this. So I actually went on the website to see what is it that DeVry is allowing you to become a cybersecurity expert in, thinking that might help answer our question, and it didn't help. But I'm glad to see that this has actually become a cottage industry, and just the whole introduction of legislation has created jobs. So well done. So we've got a really great panel here this morning, or this afternoon, sorry. And I want to just introduce everyone. Lost my card here. So I'm going to start with Brandon from Senator Reed's office. He just want to say hello and Tommy. Anyway, Brandon's down there.
My grandfather just had a heart attack somewhere in Tennessee.
Sorry, I have two Brandons. I have Brandon Milhorn, who's the staff director with Senate Homeland Security, who's down there, and then I have Brandon Ritchie, so we've got two of those, as well as I've got Tommy Matt McCabe from the House Homeland Security, and Jake Olcott, also from Senate Commerce. So we've got a fantastic panel this afternoon. I'm just going to start by asking you guys each a question and getting your comments on this. You all are working on various stages of legislation that started last Congress and will be taking it back up. So what is the key goal of your legislative effort, and how do you think that will change the status quo? And I'll start to my left here.
Sure, thank you. I should start with the standard disclaimer that I'm speaking here for myself and not for Senator Reed. But that said, you know, Senator Reed has had an interest in cybersecurity going back several months, a year or so, when he decided that he wanted to put together legislation in a comprehensive manner that would bring together the different Senate committees that are working across a number of jurisdictional lines. And that's really the challenge that I think we're trying to address here, is that cybersecurity is something that's pervasive in the government's work and is not really amenable to committee jurisdictional lines. So I think the main goal of our legislation, without getting into substance, is to bridge the committee jurisdictions and to do so through a process that allows for a thorough and sort of honest bipartisan debate about the issues and a bipartisan product. What we're trying to do here is really to allow our experts in the Senate, the committees, to drive the discussions about what the policy should be and what legislation should address, and to do so in a bipartisan manner. And I think they've done so really successfully so far. Our goal now is to facilitate the committees being able to continue that work and then to bring it together in a comprehensive product. I think, you know, we're looking at legislation that really runs the gamut of issues in cybersecurity, from protecting critical infrastructure to protecting personal identifiable information and, you know, everything in between. So I think for me the challenge is, you know, we've got a unique opportunity here where we seem to have both Republicans and Democrats in the House and the Senate and the Obama administration all focused on the issue and ready to do some work on it. That's an opportunity that doesn't come along very often. I mean, we look at arms control treaties, you know, every 10 years or so, and that's nuclear weapons. You know, how often are we going to get a chance to take up a cybersecurity bill? So I think, you know, we have to be ambitious here in trying to put together legislation that really does do everything that we know needs to be done to enhance our cybersecurity. At the same time, you know, I think we need to move ahead with sort of a do-no-harm principle and to avoid, you know, too much government regulation in areas that stifle innovation or create bureaucracies where less bureaucracy would allow for more immediate reaction and that kind of thing. So it's really the challenge before us is to walk that line between being as ambitious as possible, but also being restrained in areas where we know that legislation might do more harm than good. So I'll stop there, but I think you know, my focus here with Senator Reid is more to facilitate a thorough and bipartisan process rather than to predetermine any sort of substantive outcome on the legislation.
Thanks, Brandon.
Okay. Again, Brandon Ritchie with Congressman Goodlatte's office. And Congressman Goodlatte, many of you probably heard at the lunch today, he laid out some of his goals on cybersecurity legislation. We know that 90% of the critical infrastructure is in the private sector's hands, and his bill focuses more on that aspect of it. We've heard from a lot of folks that there are already some really good standards out there. NIST has some great standards, and one of the problems is trying to get the private sector to adopt those standards and put them into place and protect their networks and information. And so our legislation focuses on that. Without getting into the details of the substance, and we're still working on it, and we're in the beginning stages, but it would create some liability, limited liability protections for businesses that adopt standards, and also increase and enhance the criminal tools, criminal laws, some of the restitution laws perhaps, and others, to encourage businesses to go after those that hack into their networks. So that's the main gist of it. I think the goal is to unleash the laboratories of the private companies that can that are on the front lines in this fight and that have the best packages of information about what's really going on, to encourage them to come up with solutions to these problems, because these problems are evolving; they're not static. I think that he wants to try to work with everyone, all committees, but to enact legislation and encourage legislation that is not static, but that provides for evolution of solutions from the private sector. How it changes the status quo, we heard from Dr. Amoroso today that the evolving threat, the threat is no longer in 1999 terms, it's in 2011 terms. Yet many companies still put forth 1999 solutions to the problem. So we're hoping to encourage companies to work to enact 2011 and beyond in 2012, 2013 solutions to this threat. We've heard that many folks in the business community, maybe it's not a financial priority to do this. They don't have the finances to implement some of these things. Liability protections might tip the scale so that they'd be more likely to employ these types of new and technologically advanced strategies, and increase it on the priority list of the top folks in companies. I think I'll leave it at that for now.
Okay, Jake.
I want to thank the organizers for setting up this panel, and thank you very much for inviting me. With everybody's indulgence, I just sort of will read some quick prepared remarks and look forward to the continued dialogue on this panel, but also any of the audience questions. I think what I'd like to lay out is the threats that we're facing today in the United States in cyberspace, and then my boss, Senator Rockefeller's vision for securing cyberspace and how this legislation might change the status quo. To begin with, the threats, they're very serious, as we all know. Right now, cyber-enabled economic espionage targeting American businesses and government is the biggest threat that our country faces in cyberspace. The losses are financially staggering. In 2009, it was estimated that data theft and breaches cost $1 trillion globally. In 2010, a report suggested that cybercrime cost businesses nearly $4 million a year. The numbers don't tell the full story of what's happening, whether the theft of this intellectual property, whether it's chip designs, weapon designs, pharmaceutical formulas, manufacturing operations, our government secrets. The theft of these things reduces corporate competitiveness, economic strength, and our country's national security. And that's exactly what's happening here in the United States in the 21st century. Our competitiveness, our economic strength, our military advantages are being stolen by individuals, crime syndicates, nation states, and other adversaries who seek to use this information, these secrets, this intellectual property to achieve parity with our country in the years to come. Two questions. Why spend decades and billions of dollars in research and development when you can steal it? Why send spies to foreign countries when you can access files remotely from thousands of miles away? The other significant threat to the United States in cyberspace is to our critical infrastructure, the electric grid, chemical plants, financial systems, other national infrastructure that is essential for the functioning of our society and our economy. These infrastructures are increasingly reliant on the Internet and information technology, and as a result are also exposed to the same kinds of vulnerabilities and threats that we face in an online environment. Much has been written about this, and this audience is very familiar with reports in recent months, particularly with regard to Stuxnet. There have been a number of articles just over the weekend on this. Hopefully we will never see acts of cyber warfare or cyber terrorism, but we certainly cannot ignore the fact that there are possibilities, however unlikely. So what we know today, Shane, getting to your question, how will legislation change the status quo? What we know today is that the status quo is unacceptable. Billions of dollars in lost American intellectual property is unacceptable. The potential loss of portions of the electric grid is unacceptable. The exposure of millions of classified documents because of the actions of an insider is unacceptable. We have to recognize the efficiencies, the savings, the opportunities, and economic benefits that we achieve from an interconnected world, but striking an appropriate balance between these efficiencies, this economic boost to our economy, will be crucial to America's economic future and national security. And that's exactly what Senator Rockefeller intended to do with the legislation that he introduced in 2009. And he's now committed to working with our Senate and House colleagues on a bipartisan basis to finish the job this year. And in short, the vision that Senator Rockefeller has articulated is one to create a new 21st century public-private partnership where the private sector really is empowered to take the lead in securing our country and its businesses, and it's one that's very consistent with the message that that my colleagues have suggested already today. So we look forward to expanding remarks as we go along.
Great. Thanks, Shane. I'll talk a little bit about the principles that informed the Homeland Security Committee's consideration, well, particularly Senator Collins' principles, as it informed the Homeland Security's consideration of the bill that it reported out unanimously last Congress. I think our first objective was to make sure that our federal civilian systems were more secure. And make sure that the efforts to secure those systems weren't paperwork exercises. They weren't a function of an annual budgetary enforcement strategy, but were real-time and had real enforcement teeth on the other side. Now, the Homeland Security Committee's legislation addresses that problem by essentially doing what both the Bush administration and the Obama administration have been doing with respect to those systems, and that is moving the enforcement of best practices standards developed by NIST to the Department of Homeland Security, ensuring that a center within the Department of Homeland Security would have the ability to enforce those standards and best practices across the federal civilian government, improving the Federal Information Security Management Act by updating what had become an annual exercise in production of paper to become a real-time, more effective monitoring system for cybersecurity vulnerabilities, and to also ensure that when the federal government procures goods and services from the private sector related to information technology and related to cybersecurity, that security is not an afterthought in that process, and that the process is consistent across all agencies, so we don't have VA out doing one thing, Interior out doing another, Department of Agriculture doing something else. Make sure that there's a consistent approach, consistent informed approach to procurement across the federal government so that decisions aren't made ad hoc. That doesn't tell contractors what to build or how to build it or when to provide it, that encourages commercial off the shelf, but ultimately allows the federal government to make better decisions about security requirements in its procurement of information technology. And again, improving that enforcement mechanism on the back end. The budgetary enforcement hammer that the Office of Management Budget had through FISMA simply, we believe, is insufficient to carry out cybersecurity enforcement that occurs 24/7. It doesn't occur in annual cycles. Cybersecurity occurs 24/7, and we have to have enforcement mechanisms that can support that sort of flexibility and maneuverability. The second portion of our legislation involves interaction with the private sector, primarily through voluntary mechanisms like information sharing and technical assistance, making sure that the private sector has the information it needs to make good decisions about security. And these don't come from federal standards or federal regulation. They come from a partnership that would be led from the Department of Homeland Security, would build off standards already put in place by NIST. It would really add granularity to those standards by building best practices, by ensuring that the private sector has the information it needs to make those good decisions. And then as it relates to those most critical components of our critical infrastructure, those that, if disrupted, could cost thousands of lives, cost billions of dollars in damages, set out mechanisms for the private sector and the federal government to interact as it relates to those systems. Our legislation works primarily by building in risk-based performance requirements for those crucial components of systems. Here we're not talking about entire companies, entire systems. We're talking about those particularly critical nodes of systems, and allowing the department, working in conjunction with the private sector and other regulators, to create risk-based performance requirements that would allow those owner-operators to choose how best to secure those systems within the framework established in partnership with the private sector. And then, in the event of a real national emergency, where an attack was about to occur or information related to an attack was in the government's possession, add real guidelines for how the private sector and the government would interact in those circumstances. Far too often we've seen that in the event of a national emergency, government can come to the private sector and tell them that they need to take action to protect national security, and there's no guidelines, no statutory protections, and the companies are left to decide, well, are we going to do this for the good of the nation? What's our liability issues? How do we ensure that our stakeholders, shareholders, are protected? We think that is the recipe for exactly the wrong sort of interaction in the event of an emergency, and we need good guidelines and a framework for how that interaction should occur, and our legislation would do that. So that in many ways I think answers the status quo: improve protection of federal civilian systems and create mechanisms for interaction with the private sector, primarily voluntarily.
Great. Matt?
It's really fitting that I'm sitting here next to Brandon, because in the last Congress, Representative King partnered with Representative Harmon and filed Lieberman-Collins companion in the House. So there's a great temptation just after Brandon spoke to say, well, us too, kind of. But before supporting the Lieberman-Collins bill, we took a look at it, and obviously a lot of good vested work was in it, and there were a lot of efforts in it that we're comfortable with. And one of the reasons we went forward in that way is because our committee had not worked on any kind of comprehensive cyber package. And going forward in the new Congress, we certainly hope to. But as far as legislation, I think that I would boil it down to two subjects, resources and authorities. And a lot of this echoes what Brandon just talked about, but in the King Harmon or Lieberman Collins bill last year. We thought that the FSMA reform was absolutely essential, which Brandon just talked about a lot, and I won't repeat it, but real-time reporting and also just an interagency quagmire of supporting who has what roles. There's a lot of work that's already been done with the department, and we want to leverage off that, and we want to support the department's role within the federal information sector. As far as for private cooperation, we greatly appreciated the mechanism that was used. It didn't fall into a pitfall of overly burdensome regulatory scheme. It relied on certifications and follow-up evaluations, and we thought that that was a more proper way to go. The liability protections in emergency declarations were something that I greatly appreciated. I don't think that you can have a true partnership with industry, especially in times of such crisis, unless you're giving them those kind of assurances and the flexibilities as well. I mean, I don't think that there's anybody who would question that this all needs to be performance-based, that there is no single solution, or it's just not a good idea to mandate any kind of one protection because it's essential. I mean, each industry will tell you that they have specific and unique risks. So I think that relying on a performance-based initiative is the way to go.
Thank you. You guys did a great job of pointing out kind of the dual challenge that this legislation brings out, which is one is what is the government doing and how can you use the U.S. government power and an almighty dollar to bring best-in-class service to anyone who wants to use the network. The whole network is sort of like sharing a river. You know, hopefully, if you get to choose your real estate, you'd rather be upstream. And then the second part is on the information sharing, because we all are ultimately on the same networks. You know, what do we do to entice and induce information sharing? I know, Jake, that one of the issues that you guys have addressed in your bill is cyber risk reporting, and kind of what do you do to encourage the commercial industry to be sharing information, because they see a lot more pouring across their networks probably than just the slice of the government. Do you have any comment on that?
So, you know, there are a number of challenges, I think, in the information sharing space that I'd like to address here in a minute. But one of the fundamental issues that companies face today, and this is sort of goes back to the problems that we're facing in all this intellectual property being stolen, is that it's companies like the government have a very hard time establishing proper methods of analyzing cyber risk. And that's actually contributing to a very insecure corporate environment, but also a very insecure government environment. And by that, I mean this. Companies are required to report to the SEC in their annual filings about any specific material risks that companies face. So a particular material risk might be a company risks losing their intellectual property through not having a particularly high fence or other sorts of defensive mechanisms may not be in place. And this actually is true in cybersecurity. Unfortunately, a lot of companies just aren't really quite sure how to go about reducing their material cyber risks. And so what we're seeing is a couple of different problems that are emanating from that. One, companies aren't necessarily reporting material cyber risks in their annual filings. Though it is required by the SEC to do so, companies aren't necessarily making these reports. That's affecting the way that investors and credit rating agencies and analysts and insurance companies are going about determining how much to assign a value to this intellectual property that's being lost. So we actually think that by adjusting some of these equations, by helping companies figure out how best to assess their own material cyber risks. We might actually be able to put a harder figure on the amount of intellectual property that's being lost. That might actually incentivize companies to then implement more protections in place on their own internal systems, and we think that that might help cut down some of these losses that companies are experiencing. So that's sort of a long way of saying, on the one hand, we've got a problem in the way that we identify material cyber risk. On the other hand, I'll let somebody else jump in on this. We have an information sharing problem too, which is that this bidirectional information sharing between government and private sector, and private sector back to government, it also isn't necessarily happening. I'll allow one of my colleagues to jump in if they'd like to say a little bit more about that.
Sure. Other comments on information sharing?
Sure. We'll talk a little bit about it in the context of the Homeland Security Committee's bill. The private sector, if it is insured that its information will be protected, will share information with the federal government if there's value on the other side. If they receive value for the government. Otherwise, they're exposing the information for no reason, unnecessarily exposing. So our legislation did two things. One, there are no mandates for sharing information other than as it related to the most critical systems, and I'll get to those issues second. One, primarily voluntary. Two, clear protections for information that were reported into the department. And three, a direction to the Department of Homeland Security to share that threat information, to share the analysis of risk, to build in those best practices and go back out to the private sector with that data. Otherwise, it's not a partnership. It's a one-way street. And that is something that we have to work on and build in. Second, as it relates to those most critical systems, we believe it's incredibly important that the Department of Homeland Security, first-party regulators, first-party agencies with responsibility for those critical infrastructure in the federal government, and the private sector have a clear understanding of the baseline security of systems so that in the event of an emergency, decisions can be made more rapidly to respond to threats. And we're not here, we're not talking about every single data breach, every single piece of spam that a company gets on their internet. What we're talking about, or their email, what we're talking about are information related to breaches that could lead to the disruption of the system. And again, these are the systems that could cause these significant damages, thousands of deaths. And so we establish a reporting mechanism for that information. That allows the Department of Homeland Security, working with the private sector, to analyze that risk. It allows the federal government and the private sector to make better decisions about risk-based performance requirements, whether additional requirements are needed, whether the dial should be turned up or dialed back. It allows those companies to make better decisions about how to comply with those risk-based performance requirements. And on the other side of that mandatory reporting requirement, we have incentives, as Matt mentioned, protections from punitive damages for those companies that can demonstrate that if there is a breach, they were in compliance at the time of the attack. And that will create sort of a cyclical a cycle where reporting, changes to risk-based performance requirements, adoption, protections that we think will improve our understanding of our security environment for those most critical systems. And in combination with all that, we want to make sure that we're not changing any of the fundamental requirements of FISA or Title III or the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. Our legislation, while there might be need for reforms in CALEA or ECTA, our legislation takes those laws as we receive them and puts those requirements in place sort of over top of them instead of in addition to them or in lieu of them.
Actually, Tommy, then.
Brandon sort of segued to this, mentioning ECPA and CLIA and those kinds of things. But I think, you know, so what Jake and Brandon are talking about information sharing at the sort of company level and the operator of critical infrastructure level is extremely important, and there and the legislation that both of them are looking at, you know, is a way to facilitate that. There's some work underway in the federal government that the Senate has already been trying to push on a smaller scale basis, and that's, you know, supporting some pilot programs and that kind of thing in the Department of Defense. Financial Services, ISAC, is doing this, trying to work with individual companies to have that sort of real-time threat information sharing. And I think that's extremely important, and it's something we've been trying to facilitate with some funding and some direction to the executive branch. The other level to this, though, that I think is extremely important, and that, quite frankly, the legislation we've looked at in the Senate so far has not addressed, is information sharing at the level of, you know, ISPs and especially Tier 1 telcos. You know, you look at the Tier 1 telcos, top five or six Tier 1 telcos see 80-90% of the internet traffic in the world. I'm not sure the exact statistic, but it's somewhere in that range. So, you know, when you're looking at doing cybersecurity, you know, you imagine these Tier 1 telcos, if they could share real-time threat information and particularly and potentially ways to respond to those threats with each other and with the federal government, that would be an extremely powerful way to approach cybersecurity. And I think it's one where, you know, if we could put in place the appropriate protections to make sure that, you know, the users of the ISPs and the Tier 1 telcos, the individuals whose network communications are traveling through those fibers, you know, that information is protected, then I think that that's a concept that, you know, by and large, the American public would be comfortable with. But if it involves, you know, reading people's emails or looking into the, you know, following them around on the internet, then no one's going to be comfortable with that. And so, you know, coupling that authority to, you know, share information in that way with appropriate privacy protections, I think, is something that, you know, could lead us toward an incredibly powerful information sharing mechanism for cybersecurity that would take us leaps and bounds beyond what we're able to do right now. But as I said, you know, we have not come up with the right solution for that in the legislation we've looked at so far, and I think we're looking, hoping that the executive branch, as they have experience with these pilot programs and some other things, can give us guidance on sort of what they need to go down that road, and I hope it's a path that we'll look at as we're developing the legislation.
Okay. Another piece to this is to look at attacks that actually have happened, and to get information about those attacks and what happened in the first place to breach the system, how the attacker got away with it, in order to bring some of that information to the fore and to be able to have that information available to the government and to the private sector. You know, another piece of this is to tweak the criminal laws to make sure that the punishments are appropriate, they're up to date, that restitution goes to the companies, that there's a financial incentive to bring criminal cases, that information that is discovered will go to the companies as well as to the government. But if we can encourage more companies to go after these attackers rather than perhaps sweep it under the rug or just accept the loss, I think we can learn a lot from the attacks. So so that's another piece that I think we need to consider.
Great. Moving on to cloud computing, availability, reliability, and security are the three key components to the cloud having a comfort level for a lot of people. The commercial market obviously is a big user of the cloud. The siloed environment that I know you guys are trying to break out of with the government, are we ready to move you guys to the cloud? You ready to be cloud ready? I know it's on Vivek's list. I think it's number 6.
Well, we hop on that one since we're okay. The Governmental Affairs Committee. Senator Collins has been working with GAO on several initiatives related to cloud computing. Obviously, you know, this is one of those dual issues, right, where you want to get the information technology in, you want to build those efficiencies, but you also want to make sure the security is protected on the other side. And those are decisions that can't be made after the fact. Those are decisions that need to be made at the time. We need to be conscious of these security issues now. And so while I can't I think it's Congress's job to pronounce the appropriate use of cloud computing in the executive branch, but it is something that we are following carefully. Obviously, we see the benefits, but are concerned about that the security ramifications be well understood before we make investment decisions. And I'll just add one more thing, come back to information sharing. I'll step on Matt's toes here. It is incredibly important that the executive branch speak as a whole when it talks to the private sector as it relates to information sharing. And that includes in enforcement proceedings. If you've got companies that are giving information to the Secret Service, the FBI, Department of Homeland Security, related to an attack, related to a possible data breach, and then you turn around the next day and they've got an enforcement proceeding on top of them for possibly associated with a data breach, we need to think more carefully about that as a federal government, because we're never going to encourage the sort of information sharing, that free flow of information, if we have a fragmented regulatory enforcement environment. Now, that doesn't mean that we never enforce data breach requirements, but we do have to be clear about when we're doing them, why we're doing them, and make sure that sort of the right hand and the left hand know what they're doing in the federal government as relates to those actions.
Just to follow up on that, I think it's absolutely true. Fragmented interagency can be harmful. Unfortunately, we don't speak without unclean hands, because if the Congress wasn't fragmented in what it wanted to do, maybe the interagency authority would be a little cleaner. I would say, on the topic of information sharing, you know, just to give credit where credit's due, I think DHS does one of the best exercises with CyberStorm. And, I mean, I think that's an example of how information sharing should go forward. It's private partner cooperation, and that's part of this provided by performance-driven, flexible standards. I would question the efficacy of having information sharing that's driven through SEC disclosures. I mean, there's no more carefully drafted statements, and there's no more litigated word than materiality. So I think you got to try and foster partnership cooperation. As far as going back to the question on the cloud, I mean, I think it's inevitable. I think that once, you know, you have the operational people who can say we trust the security of cloud-based computing as much as server-based, then it's coming, so it shouldn't be feared.
I guess another side of that is with, you know, government procurement is supply chain and chain of custody issues. That looks like you guys are going more towards trust is a huge issue in the cloud, and right now that's sort of people, there's a lot of assumed trust. And I think when we talk about the government buying and purchasing items, there's probably going to need some validation. So thoughts on that? Go ahead.
The supply chain problem is one that that has very significant economic and national security ramifications for our country, certainly, and for global commerce. I think, you know, one of the problems that exists when people talk about supply chain is the sort of a definitional problem. What exactly are we talking about? So for our purposes, I'll just say that when I think of supply chain, I think of two components. I think of product assurance. Is the product that I buy, can you provide me the kinds of assurances that I expect that it's going to work as you say it will? Is there any malicious code that you've inserted in the product that I don't know about, and can you demonstrate to me that this is a product that's gone through testing and evaluations? And this applies for, you know, government off-the-shelf products as well as commercial off-the-shelf products. So one component is product assurance. The other component is life cycle security. From the beginning of the product's life, when you've invented it in your mind, to when you've written the code out, to when you've manufactured the product, to when you've packaged it and shipped it out and then installed it in my facility, can you provide me with assurances that the product hasn't been tampered with along that chain? Can you show me, can you demonstrate that, that chain of custody? So that's just for definitional purposes, that's what I think of when we think of supply chain security. And I think that, sort of what's important for our conversation is that governments around the world are having these same kinds of conversations as the shift has gone from, as governments purchase more commercial off-the-shelf technology, governments are starting to ask more questions about, well, how can we trust the product that you've created? And the good news is that here in the United States, American IT companies, along with some international companies, have really taken some significant steps forward in moving towards establishing international standards for product assurance and life cycle risk management. That's the kind of activity that we want to see going forward. We think that this can be a market differentiator for American IT companies. We think that that will allow American IT companies to sell their products globally because they can provide assurances that their that American IT products have been created using these best practices and industry-created standards. So that's the kind of activity that we really want to encourage. Of course, the problems are many, and what we're seeing in a lot of other countries is that some countries are using their procurement regulatory environments, procurement standards, and things like that to exclude American IT products from entering those markets. Whether it's USTR, Department of Commerce, International Trade Association, places like that, we really need to sort of start promoting this idea of, private sector created standards that we can then push out internationally to really incentivize American IT companies to access some of these markets.
Let's talk a little bit about the Homeland Security Committee's legislation in that context, because what our legislation says, federal government, civilian agencies, when you go out and you buy information technology systems, when you make these goods and procurements of goods and services, you need to consider risk beforehand. You need to think about it, as Jake said, from the beginning of the development throughout the life cycle of the product. You need to think about what your exposures are throughout that whole process, informed by intelligence information from our intelligence community, informed by interactions with the private sector, informed by the standards that the private sector develops for their systems, and then go out and make consistent procurement decisions instead of what is going on now, ad hoc approaches to security requirements, where one agency will set this for one requirement, you'll see another agency on a different procurement set standards and requirements a little bit differently. We need to make sure that there's consistency all across all approaches. And we need to start from the framework, as Jake said, with those international standards, those private sector developed standards in mind. That should form that baseline of the decision making. So certainly, always, we would encourage those developments and don't see it as the role of the Department of Homeland Security to step in and say what those standards should and should not be, or, as I said before, what the private sector should make or what it shouldn't make or how it should make it. Those are decisions that the private sector needs to make. But when the federal government makes procurement decisions, it needs to be speaking consistently as it relates to security requirements, and that is one of the provisions that one of the requirements that our legislation would put in place.
So I have one last question, then we'll go to the audience if you guys want to queue up behind the microphone. Timing? So it sounds like you guys have worked through a lot. How do we think this is going to go this year?
I'd just say from Senator Reid's standpoint, with regard to a lot of things, but especially something as important to our national security as this, Senator Reid can be a pretty impatient man, and I think would like to have had this done before we finished last year. So I think, we're really behind the eight ball in terms of getting it done early this year. What we we obviously have a lot of work to do, and I think that that's what will ultimately drive the timeline. We're waiting for the administration to sort of, you know, put together its proposals for the Congress to consider and its feedback to the Congress on our proposals. And that's, you know, I think it's something where, I'll be honest, we would have liked to have seen them engage sooner, but we also understand, you know, if we, you know, have a problem dealing with six or seven committees struggling over jurisdictional lines, you know, they have, you know, dozens of agencies with different equities that they're trying to bring to the table and coordinate on a common view. And so, you know, I think that's understandable, but we need to, them to engage very quickly. And then in addition to that, you know, I think we still have some work to do with our committees to, you know, make sure that we are able to put together a product that's really coherent and that makes sense from, you know, that represents all the different committee equities well. And then finally, we know we have some work to do in coordinating with the House, and, you know, I also reaching, you know, once we have a product, reaching out to the private sector to get input, that will be an extremely valuable part of our process. But while that's a lot of work and getting it done early this year may seem ambitious, that's certainly my tasking from Senator Reid, and I think what his tasking will be for his committees.
As far as Congressman Goodlatte's effort is concerned, I think we are in the process of formulating our proposal. I think we would like to solicit input from the private sector now. We would encourage you to get in touch with our office on that for other ideas to incentivize adopting new and improved and the current NIST standards, as well as different ways of skinning the cat. So we're in the process of putting that together. Encourage you to contact our office with any ideas you have.
Anyone else down there? Tell us, guys.
I would say for us, it's, you know, for timing, we'd love to answer it. First week of May, we're doing a markup, but we don't have that kind of clarity right now. Very well known is that Representative Thornberry was given a cyber initiative, and we've met with them. We've had our first discussions and talked about going forward. And it's going to be a question, just as we talked about, how we're going to get the different pieces from the different committees all put together. If the administration came out with a proposal, I think that could speed things quite a bit. But we're certainly going to be working this year on a Homeland Security bill, and hopefully we can meet with our fellow committees and we can put together something comprehensive and work with the Senate.
Great. Question from the audience? Anybody? We've answered them all. Go ahead. Can you identify yourself?
Hi, Steve DelBianco with NetChoice. And growing up, I'd listen to the radio, and you'd hear a test of the emergency broadcast system. And you hear the awoogas, awoogas, and it would say, in the event of a real emergency, you would have been informed where to tune in your area. I don't hear those so much anymore, because I think more and more we probably rely on the Internet for email, for voice over IP, for a website that I would go to where Fairfax County would describe to me what to do in this emergency. And we really do rely on that, and I don't know if it's the standard that you guys all defined, thousands of lives and millions of dollars. But if that would be at risk, thousands of lives and millions of dollars, then it says that basically all of our Internet exchange points, our routers, and our name servers could potentially be critical Internet infrastructure, all of them. And they might be subject to the requirements of the legislation that you're anticipating. Because the Internet's very distributed, decentralized, and any packet I send, the routers all over the country and all around the world can handle the traffic. So the question would be, would all Internet routing and transfer equipment be considered critical or just some? And if it's only some, how would you guys figure out which parts of our Internet infrastructure have to be subject to the requirements?
Well, I think that's directed at the Homeland Security Committee's bills. I'll sort of take the first shot at that. Our legislation starts out with the Tier 1, Tier 2 critical infrastructure list that the Department of Homeland Security is sort of a baseline for determining what is and is not critical infrastructure. And that is a process that is defined by law. The standards for what gets you on that Tier 1, Tier 2 list are laid out. I think it's – I'm going to try this, but don't hold me to the exact standards. 2,500 immediate fatalities, $20 billion in first-year economic losses, a significant dislocation or requirement to move from an area for a period longer than 6 months, and then there's one more that is slipping my mind. But it's not just that one of those, it's that two of those have to be met. And the while the legislation does not foreclose additional requirements or additional additions to the list, the report for the bill does cite, again, the Tier 1, Tier 2 process the Department of Homeland Security already has in place. We added an additional mechanism to protect companies who have a system or asset that has been identified or placed on the list, and it's a mechanism for them to come in and say, no, here's why this system, this asset should not be included on the list. You know, we've done all these things to limit the implications of the. And again, we're not talking about, you know, the HR system at a nuclear power plant. We're talking about, you know, the mechanism that controls the electronic mechanism that controls the water that goes into the cooling tower. That's my non-technical, non-nuclear scientist explanation. I like to think of it as the Hoover Dam, right? For that business that's located beside the Hoover Dam, you know, we're not trying to require that they do anything with their data security. We want to make sure that they have information they need to make good decisions about cybersecurity. We're not talking about all the systems at the Hoover Dam. We're not talking about their personnel system necessarily. We're not talking about, you know, their phone system necessarily. We're not talking about all those systems. But we are very concerned about an electronic control system that could cause the floodgates to come open at the Hoover Dam and kill thousands of people in the process. That's a significant concern. And the government needs to understand what security baselines are in place for those systems. So, again, we're not trying to mandate requirements for the entire Internet, the entire Internet backbone, but for those crucial components that form our nation's critical infrastructure, those most sensitive systems, we are trying to develop a framework for making sure they meet the risk-based performance requirements laid out in the bill.
Tommy.
I think, you know, Brandon and his colleagues on the committee have spent a lot of time looking at the definition of critical infrastructure. I think they've done a pretty good job. I do think that your question also raises another point, which is that, you know, if we're going to have a real conversation about cybersecurity, it has to include not only, you know, how do we secure our networks using technology and, you know, good security protocols and whatever, but also it needs to include a conversation about, you know, decisions that we make about when use of information technology is appropriate, when it's not, and when we need to have information technology solutions with alternatives as backups. And I think that's a conversation we have not had nearly enough. And, you know, whether it's emergency broadcasting or, you know, the aircraft control towers or whatever, you know, there are a lot of instances where, you know, Internet makes our lives a lot easier, but it might be a good idea to have a non-Internet related backup. And right. I think that's just a conversation we need to be facilitating as a nation.
Right. Cybersecurity is not a technical only threat, right? It can come from personnel security issues. It can come from management lack of proper management controls. It can come from lack of appropriate technical controls. Depending on, no matter how you get to the threat, there are various ways to mitigate it. And if a company or a provider puts in place mitigation mechanisms that allow a system to function without those requirements, that don't allow it to be exposed to the, or don't allow, wouldn't, that wouldn't allow the disruption of that system to cause those significant damages, then that's action that we believe would be appropriate and would take them out of that a mandatory framework. You know, but those are mitigation decisions that companies have to make, that the federal government shouldn't make for them. So our legislation sort of takes it as owner operators come to us and says, okay, how are you going to mitigate those threats? And that's what our legislation strives to do.
Jake, do you have anything to add to that?
Just real brief, I think that all these conversations tie into the sort of the fundamental problem, which is what is a material cyber risk? And unfortunately today, it's just not that information is not really widely discussed within within the corporate environment. It's discussed primarily in the chief information security officer's office, but doesn't necessarily get to some of these other very important components: the risk manager, the general counsel, the CEO. Those are all really important individuals who have to make these kinds of decisions in identifying what critical cyber risks are.
And to be clear, our legislation does not say that the Department of Homeland Security shall say what those cyber risks are that you need to insure against. What it says is DHS and the private sector and the regulatory agencies that have responsibilities for those systems should all come together and make decisions about what is covered critical infrastructure, what are the risk-based performance requirements that you expect that covered critical infrastructure to meet. That's a decision that has to be made jointly with the private sector and other entities.
Hi, go ahead.
Great. Craig Spiezel, Online Trust Alliance. A few comments. One, I want to thank. I've been working with many of you in different aspects. The level of collaboration with private sector, the NGO community, I think has been great. We're talking about fundamentals and some of the basics. I'd like to kind of see how we can work together to advance some of these as kind of a North Star for business. For example, DNSSEC. In the past 2 weeks, FDIC and the White House have been spoofed with deceptive email compromising both consumers and federal employees. So what can we do to not only legislate out, but what can we do to kind of, walk the talk internally and help advance these and work together? So I'd like to kind of get some feedback on those areas.
You want to take that one?
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate the thought. I mean, a lot of us, we spend a lot of time trying to figure out how to, how to incentivize some of these actions, and it's not always legislation, right? So, I think that there's a consensus here that government should be able to provide that leadership, and so I think that you have seen some actions by the government to encourage some of these activities to happen, whether it's NTIA or Commerce really sort of leading the way on pushing out DNSSEC. I'm also thinking of DHS and the Science and Technology Division spending a lot of time and resources trying to improve some of those protocols. But it really is probably going to take government leadership, whether it's setting specific dates certain that this is the time that we're going to deploy DNSSEC across our systems, or I'm even thinking of something like IPv6, which we know that other governments have really driven this driven adoption, and to the extent that we can encourage that from the federal position, we need to do that.
Hey, by the way, just to clarify, I mean, we've got great support. The Van Hitch and the CIO Council is working together in these areas with us. OMB in the NIST strategy with Howard and his team call out these areas. So I didn't mean that to say not's not happening, enough's not happening fast enough. But we sometimes, the business sector, I think we have an opportunity to lead by example. So thank you.
Hi. Pam Walker with the National Association of State Chief Information Officers. And my question to all of you is, a lot has been focused and a lot of the legislation is dealing with the private sector and the federal government. And state and local governments actually, is the nexus to your identity and contain a lot of information in their systems. Plus, the federal government provides a lot of funding to the states for various programs, but cybersecurity is not a component of those. And so I was wondering, is your legislation going to look at sharing information with states or maybe addressing some of the grant programs that are out there through Homeland Security in getting cyber, moving it higher up on the priority, especially when it comes to the grants coming from out of DHS?
Let's say the Homeland Security Committee's bill, as it relates to voluntary information sharing, to technical assistance programs, to development of best practice, includes state and local governments in the context of that program that the legislation would create.
That's great.
Well, I just add, you know, I actually spent a lot of time out in Nevada dealing with state and local cybersecurity experts out there and have learned a lot about their challenges. And, you know, I think one thing I wasn't particularly aware of was that was to what extent state and local networks are actually connected to the federal government networks. I mean, so it's not just a matter of you know, state and local governments, you know, being critical infrastructure in and of themselves. They're also, you know, entrance points into federal government networks. So I think it would be terribly unfortunate if we didn't take this opportunity to make sure that, you know, there is adequate federal support to state and local governments, adequate information sharing both ways, and, you know, a overall cooperative effort to elevate cybersecurity across the board.
I'd say too that just a cautionary note to whatever we do in this realm, we don't, you know, impose the one size fits all mandate on the states, because they're laboratories of innovation as well, and we want to make sure we're reaping the rewards of that.
I will say one great challenge with that is state and local grant funding has to be risk based. I mean, it's an absolute priority, and when you're dealing with specific pieces of critical infrastructure, say a tunnel or a bridge, it's a lot easier to determine than in the cyber field. And I would try and attach funding for that to the critical infrastructure that is underlying.
People actually don't necessarily realize that state governments and local government IT professionals actually in a lot of cases are running critical infrastructure facilities in state and local, you know, in that state or that city. You know, there are a lot of responsibilities for the state and local chief information officers, and so the, you know, Tommy was sort of talking about the interconnectivity between state networks and federal networks. I mean, we also have to be concerned that that state CIOs and local CIOs don't necessarily have the same resources to protect those pieces of critical infrastructure that we're actually talking about here, too. So it's a very significant challenge that we face.
We are actually at our time. Thank you all. I want to let you know that the organizers have asked me to tell you there is a cocktail reception outside and to the left when you exit out here. Can we thank everybody for their time that they've spent today on this?
Why they always do these things on the Senate.